Happy New Year, everyone. Before we get to our lucky 13th episode, I wanted to apologize for the unannounced hiatus we took as we finished out the year at the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. 2017 was a big year for the foundation, and if you want to know all that we did, please check out alhirschfeldfoundation.org/news. We did end the year in the Los Angeles area for a series of pop-up galleries, and it was wonderful to meet up with some listeners of this podcast. Thank you for your comments, accolades, and advice. We are also delighted to have this new episode in a new year begin with a new theme song by the legendary pianist Dick Hyman. This wonderful piece is titled Three or More Ninas. To learn more about Dick and his music, please visit dickhyman.com. You can see the debut of the complete piece at the screening room on our website. Now, as Irving Berlin famously wrote, let's get on with the show.
Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
And I'm David Leopold, the Creative Director.
Yes. And we are here with a new episode, back again.
Yes, on a subject that is, I think, on everybody's mind. It seems like this last year, this has been on everyone's mind. And that subject is politics.
Yes, which you don't usually think about politics when you think about Hirschfeld. And it's true, there's not... Well, there's more than you might imagine, I guess.
There's actually a lot of political drawings in his career, or drawings that could be considered political.
Yes, and but it's not what we think of when we think of Al Hirschfeld.
No, in fact, he really never used his platform to promote any sort of didactic message.
Right.
It was all about the drawing for him. As a young man, he actually did do political work, straight out political work.
Yeah.
And we're going to look at that. So what were his politics as a young man?
Yes, what were they, David?
Well, I know it's a bad word to say these days, but it had to do with Russia.
That's true.
He really believed that communism was a great thing.
And I think a lot of people of the time did.
Sure. He believed that everybody should have a role. Everybody should be paid equally. Everybody should have a job.
Right.
That it was a collective thing that we were in. He saw America as a collective. He never joined the party. I asked him once if he ever joined the Communist Party, and he said no. He thought it was a Lonely Hearts Club for pimply faced kids. So, which is exactly what Al Hirschfeld would have said.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a joiner by nature. He had political ideals, but he was always just in the party of Al Hirschfeld.
Right. And now he was married to his first wife, Flo.
Yes.
Who was a showgirl in Earl Carroll's Vanities.
Correct. He was, she starred with Peggy Hopkins Joyce, who was famous for being famous and for having six husbands.
Gotcha.
He married her despite the fact that she was completely different from him. She was a Broadway showgirl who liked to party. And while Al Hirschfeld liked to have a good time, he liked to work first and foremost. He liked to draw. And he sort of never got over his sort of Midwest upbringing. He told me later he didn't like to see a woman get drunk.
Mm.
And when I read his letters that he wrote to Flo from his first trip to Paris in 1925, I was amazed at how different they seemed, that he was sort of telling her to stay away from this Broadway crowd, you know, and, you know, just the hard drinking, hard partying types.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally said to him, you seem so different. Why did you marry her?
Right.
He said, because everyone told me not to.
That's a good enough reason.
And classic Al Hirschfeld.
Yeah.
But when they got married, they decided to honeymoon in Russia.
Right. And you couldn't go straight to Russia, so they stopped in Paris for a visa.
He still had a studio there that he had signed a lease, an 8-year lease on in 1925, in the fall of 1925. So they had a place to stay. He actually did drawings when he was there. In the Hirschfeld Century book, we have one of the drawings he did from the Ambassador Club.
Right, right.
With Sidney Bechet and Buster West and Noble Sissel.
Right.
A really wonderful drawing.
Yeah. I like that one.
But when Al went to Russia, he said in an interview maybe 50 years later, "I was very interested in the whole of the Soviet Union and in communism at the time, which I thought was the salvation of the world then. Nothing happened in that time that I was there to disillusion me, actually."
Mm-hmm.
So he really, he loved it there.
What year was this?
This was 1928 got there, and he spent about 5 months there. He had been made an international correspondent by the Herald Tribune, and he sent back articles on the Russian theater and film scene.
Right.
Sometimes the articles would be bylined to his wife, but mm-hmm. he told me that he wrote the articles. He was just trying to boost her along, and I think he wanted to have sort of a writer-artist combo
right.
That he would actually later achieve with S.J. Perlman.
Mm.
while he was there, it's probably very well known at this point, he did write a book about his entire experiences there that was lost by his publisher when he returned from his travels.
So sad.
And he hadn't made a copy of either the drawings or the manuscript. So we don't know what it is.
That's why I have a backup on my hard drive, and that's why I back up my hard drive to another hard drive. Always back up your stuff.
Then a backup would have been either him retyping
copy.
It or yeah. a carbon copy. Yeah. And it was just, he was 25 years old.
Yeah.
No, he was a young person. I don't think he had thought it all the way through. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Even though he was doing great at that time, he didn't think it all the way through.
Yeah.
But politics.
Yes.
Back to politics.
Yes. So he was there in Russia for the apex of Russian theater. Film scene.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And really of the communist culture in its first flush.
Right.
You know, what he saw there, as he said, didn't dissuade him at all from his political leanings.
Mm-hmm.
And.
Well, Russia was much better off than it had been 12 years earlier.
Right. Under the Tsar, the difference was significant. And
right.
he saw it as potentially a model for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He was not an anarchist. He didn't come back, you know, distributing pamphlets or anything like that, but he really thought there, as he said, there was nothing about communism that he had seen in practice that dissuaded him from believing that it was a potent form of politics.
Mm-hmm.
He did two lithographs while he was there, the Russian Worker and a railway station, that are very fine works, very different from his theater work and,
yes,
his, and his film work. Lithography, which we'll go into in later in the podcast, mm-hmm. would be a very potent outlet for his political ideals.
Right.
And though, as much as he enjoyed Russia when he went there in 1928, when he returned 8 years later for the Russian Theater Festival with Brooks Atkinson, he was terribly disappointed.
Mm. And what had changed?
I think everything had changed.
Or nothing.
Well, you know, when he was there before, all the officials were very normal people. When he got back there in 1936, he described it to me as their chests were covered with medals. He said they looked like Saul Steinberg drawings.
Right.
And the productions that he had thought were incredible in 1928 turned out to be literally the exact same productions.
Right. And that's why I said that nothing had changed.
Right.
With the theater or film scene, it was all what was being done, you know.
Sure.
8 years earlier.
And so what had been fresh now seemed very stale.
Right, right.
And I think it changed his opinion of communism mm-hmm. in general. And in fact, later on, he would later include the communists as one of the things that ruined Bali.
Mm.
You know, he felt that they had sort of overrun the island in 1947.
Oh, wow.
So it was a little bit of an awakening for him.
Sure.
Now, back at home, he didn't rush to do political work, but One could argue that the work that he was doing for newspapers and films were very fit to his political ideals perfectly, because they were art that was available to everyone.
Right. They were printed on cheap paper and everybody could afford to get a newspaper. I know that Whoopi Goldberg later would say that that's why she loved Hirschfeld, you know, the drawing so much, was that they could afford it.
Yeah, anybody could access it.
You didn't have to go to the museum or...
You could just pass by theaters or see it on the side of buildings.
Right.
His posters were everywhere.
Right, right.
But he started doing more political work in 1933 when he started to co-publish a magazine called Americana with his friend Alexander King.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was a satiric magazine. It wasn't strictly political, but the satire was, it was graphic satire that often had a political bent.
Mm-hmm.
They were really one of the first publications that used, would manipulate photographs for humor.
Oh, gotcha. Now, is this the same magazine he did the Jimmy Durante and Joseph Stalin?
No, that was for Life magazine.
Oh, okay. But it was that same kind of idea.
Right.
Okay. So what I'm talking about is something different, and I'll post it in the show notes so you can see now. But it's where, you know, with a few strokes of Al Hirschfeld's pen, he could transform a photograph of someone into someone else.
Right.
That they might not have really even looked like, but just a few little changes can make them look like something completely different.
It famously got him banned from The New Yorker.
Correct.
When he turned Harold Ross into Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, it's a good one. It really does look like Joseph Stalin.
But it also goes to the heart, I think I've said this before, is it goes to the heart of what Hirschfeld was about, that it wasn't about necessarily anatomical distortion.
Right.
That it was the idea that Jimmy Durante had a big nose.
Right.
His nose was maybe bigger than the average guy's, but it wasn't so big.
Right, right, right.
But once you made it the focus, it seemed bigger than it actually was. So in this magazine with Alex King, it came out every month. They had a lot of wonderful artists who were given a page. And as Al told me, that if the artist didn't submit anything that month for the magazine, the page went blank with their name on
that's
it.
That's funny.
But this is when he starts doing much more overt, in fact, perhaps some of the most overt political work of his career. He did a piece, a lot of it was anti-Nazi, anti-fascism.
Which is so early, if it's 1933.
Right.
They're ahead of his time.
Right. They're very conscious of what's going on in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of the artists that they bring over to contribute to the magazine is George Grosz. When George Grosz comes to America, the two guys who meet him on the at the dock are Al Hirschfeld and Alexander King.
Oh, that's funny.
But Hirschfeld would do not only anti-Nazi and anti-fascist cartoons, he would also poke fun at FDR and his cabinet. There is a very wonderful piece in which he took a piece of wood and carved a wooden nickel for William Hartman Wooden, who was the Treasury Secretary under FDR.
And it's a real, it's like a real piece of wood.
It is a real piece of wood.
That he carved.
He kept it on top of his file cabinet as sort of like a paperweight for decades. It's now
That's
in the collection
great.
Of a Library of Congress. But and what they used in the magazine, they took a photograph of it, and they just had it in the. But it's a wonderful caricature that Hirschfeld did in wood as opposed to ink.
That's interesting.
So, but there were also things like inflation, which showed a what would obviously be a fat man's head on a skeleton body.
Right.
And that was done in November 1933. And eventually the magazine was bought out by Vanity Fair, who saw it as competition. And they were brought into the fold of Vanity Fair. Al contributed one piece, and soon thereafter, Vanity Fair folded.
Oh, gosh. Because of the Depression.
Well, Al thought that it was because Frank Crowenshield, the editor of Vanity Fair, would not accept the Depression. He refused to cover it in his magazine. And that could only work for so long.
Right.
When it's such a all-encompassing thing in America, if you're a popular magazine, you have to address the issue.
Right, right.
He would continue to do political work, not for Vanity Fair, but for the New Masses, which was probably the most articulate publication of the left.
Now, was this a communist magazine?
It was not a communist magazine, but it had strong communist leanings.
Okay.
It had been around for, it had started off as the Masses and it had been revived in the early 30s as the New Masses. Mm. It was a very, very important magazine for the left, for left thinkers, for left artists, probably second only to the Daily Worker.
Oh, wow.
Which was the Communist Party newspaper.
So it was very close.
Yes. And he started off, he did covers. I think the very first thing he ever did for them was a cover for Martha Graham.
Right, it was.
But he did a lot of cartoons for them over the years. This is 36, 37, 38. Again, anti-fascist, anti-Nazi. There was also one called The Isolationist, which showed a fellow sitting in an easy chair next to a globe in which he's cut off half the globe.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of attacking Americans who wanted to, thought they would could stay out of the war.
It's Europe's war.
Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
And he goes up, he does work there till 1939. Mm. And it, in fact, it's a cartoon that ends his relationship with the New Masses. He does a drawing of Father Conklin, who was a radio preacher who had very, very virulent nationalist, racist leanings, always asking people for money. And Hirschfeld was appalled that his father was listening and sending money in, too.
We've all been there.
Speak for yourself. Happy to say my father and mother never have embarrassed me politically.
That's good.
But he did this drawing of Father Conklin, which showed him with swastikas etched in his eyeglasses and a little sort of Hitler-looking like mouse on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. And he was holding the Ten Commandments, and there was one at the bottom, the 11th Commandment, which was, why are you a congressman? Mm. And Hirschfeld really unloaded all of his bile toward Father Conklin. And he sent it down to New Masses, thinking they're going to just run this. This is great. And they didn't run it. And he called up and he said, what's the problem? They said, we have to come up and speak to you, Hirschfeld.
Uh-oh.
So, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what he thought. Yeah. Well, this group comes up to Hirschfeld's studio and tries to make him see that they can't publish the cartoon because it would offend Catholic trade unionists. Which Hirschfeld thought was ridiculous. It was no more an attack on Catholicism than anything else. And it was obviously not that. And how could they be offended? And then he pointed out to them that, indeed, weren't they the people that said that there was no God, that religion was the opiate of the masses?
Yeah.
That did not convince them. Mm. And not surprisingly, they did not convince Hirschfeld to change his opinion. Hirschfeld would later say that the only thing he got out of the evening was a few pipe burns on his sofa.
Mm. And was that drawing ever run anywhere?
It was never run anywhere, and we only know about it because Hirschfeld describes it in The World of Hirschfeld.
Right.
But he didn't have it.
It's somewhere.
Check
your attic.
Check your attic or somebody's trash can. I'm not sure. Yeah. But Hirschfeld would later very humorously write that it was that night he realized he was closer to Groucho Marx than to Karl Marx.
Yes, aren't we all?
But he was simultaneously with doing New Masses, he appeared in Ken magazine, which was a large format pictorial political magazine that was short-lived. But it was it may not have gone on long, but it seems that everybody who read it was an important person. Hirschfeld did, I think probably his best cartoon was called Spain 1938, ran in May 1938. Mm. And it showed bulls sitting in the stands of a stadium as Spaniards toradored each other.
Oh, fine.
He was really poking fun, alas, at the Spanish Civil War.
Right.
Now, his most complex cartoon was his ambitious History of the American Communist Party that was done for, of all publications, Fortune magazine in November 1940.
That is kind of funny.
It is a very,
November 1940, that's when my granny was born. I just realized.
She is not featured in the cartoon. No. But there are two granny-like figures in the cartoon at one point. It shows, it puts the American Communist Party as like a train.
Yes, it's like a map / train. Yeah.
And the train starts off as this little pokey thing and along the way becomes a streamliner, right, and whatnot. And at one point it goes off the rails.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it has all these wonderful visual metaphors.
It actually reminds me of like his map of Central Park.
Right.
That's also a very detailed drawing.
Done around the same time.
Very similar. Yeah, yeah. They're very detailed.
Very detailed. And this one is actually historically accurate.
Mm.
Full
Seems
of,
like he did a lot of research for it.
He did a tremendous amount of research for it, and he was very proud of it.
Mm.
I remember when he was doing a book called Art and Recollections from 8 Decades, a Scribner's book in 1990, Alistair Cook was writing the foreword to it. And Al was very anxious to show off some of his work to Alistair Cook.
Mm.
And one of the very first pieces he showed him was this one, History of the American Communist Party.
And what was his response?
Oh, Alistair Cook loved
it.
Because he understood what was in it. He could look at the cartoon. You and I would have to, we would almost need an answer key.
Right.
To know what all the references to, Alistair Cook knew right away. And it turned out that Alistair Cook had started off as a cartoonist.
Oh, wow.
So they had a real sort of mutual admiration society.
Gotcha. Now, speaking of cartoons, you've been calling this political work cartoons, whereas we usually, you know, at the foundation, we usually shy away from saying Hirschfeld cartoons. We refer to them as drawings because that's what they are. You know, they're caricatures, but they're drawings, first and foremost, but you've been referring to these as cartoons. So when you use the word cartoon, are you referring to more the intent behind the drawing, behind the art, rather than the style that they're done in?
Yes, I would say
so. Is there like a what am I trying to say?
Well, these are drawings that illustrate an idea.
Right, and that's why you're using the term cartoon.
Right,
because it's the intent
of it. Well, oftentimes they also have a caption.
Right, and we know that Hirschfeld didn't like captions.
He would later say a caption on a drawing was a toe-curling admission of failure. but at this time, and let the record show that he was friends with many, many cartoonists.
Sure, sure.
He really loved their work. He was like everybody else when he got the New Yorker. He looked at all the cartoons first. Oftentimes they were friends of his, but he loved a good cartoon. He loved a good gag cartoon. And he was doing them because he thought this was the best way he could get his message across.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the point of view that he wanted to share. This was the opportunity for him to do that. So almost all these drawings have a caption, a title at the top or a caption on the bottom that sort of gives you the punchline of the cartoon, even if it isn't always funny.
Right.
But he's using the title or the caption to sort of illuminate the cartoon.
Yeah, yeah, steer you in the right direction of what it's all about.
Right, but he would later come to say that if you were drawing a woman knitting and the thing that she was knitting said Jewish consciousness, he thought that you had failed.
Mm.
Because if you have to tell people what
it's like explaining a joke.
Right, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And so he was, while he would become less than enthusiastic about it for himself, he continued to do it. When in the early 1940s, there was an afternoon newspaper that joined New York's crowded newspaper scene. It was called PM because it came out in the afternoon.
Shocking.
And it was... It was an unusual newspaper in the fact that it accepted no advertising.
Mm.
It did not want to be swayed by advertisers. When it was originally published, it was actually stapled together like a magazine, but eventually it became more tabloid size. And it attracted a lot of writers and a lot of artists who liked its political ideals. And so among the cartoonists that Hirschfeld contributed cartoons. Again, these are anti-fascist, anti-German. He pokes fun also at figures like John L. Lewis, who was the head of the mine workers who called a coal strike at the beginning in 1943, near the beginning of World War II, which he thought was unusual and he was not a fan of.
Right.
but also, you know, he poked fun at Roosevelt and at Churchill. But among the artists who were also contributing political cartoons to PM was Dr. Seuss, Ted Geisel. So this was a place where artists could sort of go outside their usual zone and do work. Again, I think that they felt that they were adding to the war effort.
Right. You know, that they were helping their way to contribute.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Hirschfeld, to be clear, also aided the war effort literally for the government in the sense that he would go to see soldiers recuperating in hospitals, and he would go to their beds and do quick drawings of them and give them to them.
I didn't know that. You never told me that, David. That's so sweet.
We have a copy of one of those
drawings. That's so Bob Hope of him.
But so many stars like Bob Hope and Irving Berlin, these were all people, they were doing it out of true patriotic enthusiasm.
Right.
They wanted to help their country. Mm-hmm. Al Hirschfeld at the start of World War II was 38 years old.
He was kind of that in-between generation that was too young for World War I and too old for World War II.
Right.
But still felt like they had to do something.
Right. They wanted to do their part.
Right.
And he wasn't going to go into a factory and start making cannons or something like that. What he could do was what he did best and what people wanted him to do. Mm-hmm. So he did a lot of drawings for different army units. Mm. He worked with Billy Rose. Billy Rose had this idea of performing units to entertain the troops, and his proposal to the army was actually illustrated with Hirschfeld drawings.
Right.
We don't have those up on the website. Mm-hmm. We're going to do a feature on that at some time in the future.
That's a
good
idea.
But it's really wonderful. There's a fellow who's writing a biography of Billy Rose, which we're looking forward to, and he shared that with us, so it was really terrific. His final cartoon was in 1948 for Collier's Magazine. I mean, PM, he did for about a year or so in PM. Mm-hmm. And as Hirschfeld told me, that he knew that PM would not last because on the day that the Germans rolled into Paris, he told me that the front page of PM was about a kosher deli racket exposed.
Oh, no.
So, I mean, he thought that they just had their priorities in the wrong places.
Just like Vanity Fair.
Right.
You have to acknowledge it.
And Hirschfeld will tell you that he closed many, many significant publications over the years.
Including Collier's, which is what we're going to talk about next.
Right. So Collier's in 1948, it's the fall of 1948, and they're convinced, along with just about every other pundit and expert in the field, that Harry Truman is going to lose the 1948 presidential election.
Right.
There's a very famous photo of Truman holding up a paper that says, Dewey defeats Truman. Collier's had gone them one better and had organized and published an entire issue that they were going to release.
Wait, it was already published?
Oh, it was printed. It was the whole thing.
Oh, it was printed.
It was printed, but it was not released.
Okay.
That was all about Dewey beating Truman.
That's so funny.
And they had asked Hirschfeld for a cartoon that is called Retreat from Washington, and it shows the Trumans moving out of the White House.
Right.
Although you never actually see the Trumans in the drawing, it's all the things that we know would be in the Truman White House.
And what would that be? Like a cowboy hat?
Oh, there was modern art and things like that.
Gotcha.
It was an unusual drawing. We discovered it in a studio around 1990, and it's published in the book, actually, that Scribner's book. And when I first saw it, I was like, what does this mean, retreat from Washington? And he proceeded to tell me the story about doing this drawing and it never being published.
Aww.
Now, I said I would talk about lithographs.
Yes.
I mean, the lithographs, wouldn't you agree, are a unique part of Hirschfeld's work?
Definitely. They're very different from anything else he did, I think.
They're not as concerned with line.
No, definitely not.
Much more about textures and grayscale. Mm-hmm. And
they're all very political.
Yes.
Without being overtly so. These are ones that you, I think a lot of them you do have to kind of see the title. It helps.
Right. It's graphic satire.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's one of an artist, it turns out he's out in front of the British Museum, and he's got his artwork. He's sitting on the street, or sitting on the sidewalk, and his pieces are all lined up on a fence right next to him. Our viewpoint is As people are walking by, we can see a dog peeing on one of the canvases, and the title of the piece is Art and Industry.
Right. That's cute.
So it's really a wonderful one. Even hit some of his earliest ones, there was one called The Hook Shop, which shows a brothel in Paris.
Right.
And again, there's definitely class distinctions there.
Mm, interesting.
As said, the two that he produced from his Russian trip, it's a Soviet worker.
Yep. Very similar to that Soviet worker drawing he did.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably did the drawing while he was there and then would later come and do the lithograph.
And the Kharkov Railroad Station.
Sure.
Which is the same.
So the piece that he did for Vanity Fair was actually a lithograph.
Mm.
It was called Nine Old Men of the Supreme Court.
Oh, yes.
And this was these nine Supreme Court justices, which Hirschfeld claimed were 675 years old.
Yes. And now, we don't like to call Al Hirschfeld a liar.
We really don't.
But I did the math.
Okay.
I did the math. In 1933, when this we're talking about the 1933 one?
Well, 1933, and he would later do a different version in 1937.
So in 1933, all nine old men of the Supreme Court, their ages totaled 612, unless this drawing was published in December, because Brandeis had a birthday in November. Everybody else was much more earlier in the year. So 612 or 613 years. Then I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. And I went and did the 1937 totals of those same nine old men. I got 649 to 658, again, based on what month it was published and who had already had a birthday.
Wow.
So, granted, he didn't have the benefit of Wikipedia like I did
or
an iPhone calculator. Which I used and got this all very quickly. But he did have 17 extra years, and I don't know where they came from.
In his defense, I don't think he always put the same amount of years on every... Sometimes he would... Often.
Because I feel like we've seen two lithographs with two different inscriptions.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
He would often inscribe the pieces with the judges' names, the justices' names, and he would add their ages.
Yes.
But of course, nobody was looking for accuracy.
Where would you get that? That would take so long to get that information.
Yes, at that time it would have been very
much so. I feel he was very close, but I feel like it might have been like a guesstimate.
Right.
But I did the research for all of you at home, so don't worry. I'm always
many things in a Hirschfeld drawing, it appears to be accurate, and it's the effect is what is important.
Right.
Because what is it about these nine old men? The Supreme Court of 1933 was comprised of largely conservative justices who seemed intent on blocking the progress of Roosevelt's New Deal.
Mm.
FDR, who had won the largest landslide election, he had introduced legislation that would allow him to appoint a new member of the Supreme Court for each justice over 70 years old. Since six of the nine justices were over 70, this change would, quote, pack, unquote, the court with Roosevelt Democrats. And it did not pass.
Interesting.
But packing the court was something that Roosevelt was accused of, and accurately so. And in fact, if you go to the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, New York, and they have a little display on packing the court, one of the things they have is Hirschfeld's Nine Old Men of the Supreme Court lithograph.
Right, right.
So they think it was it sort of hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
It was close enough, even if it wasn't entirely accurate.
And this is the one where they are on a diagonal almost.
Yes.
And they're like in the clouds.
Right. So the first one that he did for Vanity Fair in November 1933 showed the justices in a straight line at their...
chambers?
No, at their desk.
Oh, okay. Is chambers the right word?
Chambers would be the right word if they were in there, but they weren't
in there. Okay. That was close.
So is platypus the right word if you're talking about those animals, but doesn't make it any more accurate in this situation.
Right.
In 1937, in his sketchbook, the sketchbook is now in the collection of the Library of Congress, but he had originally envisioned showing the judges in the actual courtroom. But by the time he made the lithograph, he had taken away all the sort of backdrop of the courtroom and have them in clouds on a diagonal, sort of like they're a star chamber.
Right.
And really, it's a really wonderful piece, one that he was justifiably very proud
of. Yeah, it's a very nice piece.
So his final print of the 1930s was his strongest political statement in printmaking. Yeah. It was called Peace in Our Time, and it was printed soon after the British entered World War II, and it alluded to Neville Chamberlain's famous phrase upon returning from an attempt to appease Germany. It showed Chamberlain addressing a bombed-out parliament building where all the members of parliament are wearing gas masks.
Yeah, it's very powerful.
When there was actually a bombing of parliament, Hirschfeld took the image that she had just finished. He took it to the New York Times because he thought, this is real op-ed work.
Right.
And he took it to his editor, Lester Markle, who told him that... this was a communist work because it was lithography. That lithography was meant that you were communist, and the Times would not publish it.
Because then they said it was communist because it could be mass produced.
Right.
Right.
And they suggested the New Masses, which Hirschfeld had already been contributing to. And indeed, Hirschfeld took it to the New Masses, which printed it as a double page spread. This is the last piece he published in New Masses, because the next one he would do would be the Father Conklin.
Gotcha.
Years later, though, it's funny. The British war effort there was a fundraiser in New York for the British war effort, and the British asked to reproduce Hirschfeld's Peace in Our Time in the program. And Hirschfeld, of course, was delighted and allowed it. And when he got a copy of the program, he went over to the Times and showed it to Lester Markle, to sort of say, it's not communist.
Right.
And Markle's response was, who'd have thunk it? The British are communists too.
That's funny. So he wouldn't give in.
No.
All right. So the next thing that we're going to talk about is the American Mercuries. Originally what I wanted this episode to be on. And then we said, well, why don't we
She has a lot of pull in this.
Yeah. And then you said, well, why don't we just do it all in politics? So we'll expand it. American Mercury was a little TV guide digest size magazine that featured a lot of political articles and artwork. Yeah.
It had been started in the 20s by H.L. Mencken and George Jean Nathan, but sometime, I don't know the exact history of it, it had been bought by Larry Spivak, I think, in the late 30s or early 40s. And it got actually more political and more sort of current events related. And in 1943... He started to have Hirschfeld do covers each month, every month.
Yeah.
Usually of world political leaders or American political leaders or political figures. And the first one was a New Hampshire governor who, Leverett Slattenstall. I mean, these names you
can't. Saltonstall.
Saltonstall. Yeah. I'm sorry. I think these are names that S.J. Perlman would have loved and they have made up.
That's a good one.
He was a senator for more than 20 years, and he was a well-liked mediating force in the Republican Party. And he actually was the only member of the Republican Senate leadership to vote for the censure of Joseph McCarthy. But in 1943, he was still a governor of New Hampshire, and he obviously had designs on doing something more. And so he was featured on the cover of American Mercury.
Nice.
And over the next 3 years in which Hirschfeld's drawings appeared, and when I say drawings, they were actually paintings.
Yes, they're gouache paintings. Very nice. Very vivid.
Where he does his sort of signature style where he models it in paint.
Right.
It's not dependent on line so much, but
just like paint. The TV guide drawings,
very much like the TV guide,
Or even the Colliers,
which would come about 10 years after this,
right?
But among the cover subjects were Fiorello LaGuardia,
the airport guy,
mayor of New York. Thank you very much, Eleanor Roosevelt, Chiang Kai-shek, Madam Chiang Kai-shek, Eisenhower, Churchill, De Gaulle, Stalin, Gandhi, Dean Acheson, and there was even some classic graphic satire like Claude Pepper, Senator Claude Pepper of Florida,
his head is the shape of Florida.
Right.
It's great. It's a good
and
one.
It looks just like him.
Yeah.
There's a great one of Whitaker Chambers, who was become famous for being a Russian spy and secreting out microfilm in a hollowed out pumpkin.
What?
Yes, it's
That's
all true.
That's so Man in the High Castle.
Oh, where do you think these things come from? So Chambers is shown, his head is like a pumpkin with the top sort of askew, and there's microfilm coming out of it.
Oh my gosh.
And then there's John L. Lewis, as I said, the head of the United Mine Workers, and his eyeballs are little piles of
coal. Shovel. Yeah.
It's a really great piece.
And the Claude Pepper and John L. Lewis ones, those were featured in the Hirschfeld Century exhibition.
Sure.
Yeah.
Hirschfeld's work appeared in on American Mercury from 1943 all the way through 1946. In January of 1947, Hirschfeld leaves to spend 9 months traveling around the world with S.J. Perlman, and yet January, February, and March on American Mercury had covers by Hirschfeld. I mean, he had done a bunch of work before he left.
Yeah. Didn't want to up and leave him.
No, and in fact, through 1947, it would have been hard to know that Hirschfeld was gone because his work was appearing not only in on the cover of American Mercury, but in Seventeen magazine, in movie posters. It wasn't appearing in the New York Times, but other than that,
it's
everywhere else. But perhaps his greatest cover, he would also, by the way, he would come back in 1949 and start doing covers again for them that started off as just sort of spot drawings on the cover, but eventually returned to full color covers.
Right.
So that was all 49 and 1950. His greatest cover, though, a political cover, was the one and only one he did for The Nation magazine in November 1944 of FDR.
Right.
Showing the victory sign.
He's got like stars in his eyes.
Stars in his eye.
I feel like there's stripes somewhere.
Oh, yeah. It's a wonderful piece. He had done something similar for American Mercury in color, but this is just in black and white. And it was so vivid that FDR loved it and invited Hirschfeld to come down to the White House. Hirschfeld gave him the drawing. And unfortunately for Hirschfeld, Roosevelt appeared to be human. He had gone there he admired Roosevelt that, you know, he kind of felt he was godlike.
Yeah.
And when he got down to the Oval Office, it turns out that Roosevelt put on his pants just like everybody else.
Right.
And he lost his glasses at one point, and his cigarette fell out of his cigarette holder, and he started posing in profile for Hirschfeld. And Hirschfeld thought that was just the phoniest thing that you could do. And he left there thinking, well, I'm glad I didn't meet Lincoln.
Right.
You know, so it was.
That's funny.
But while he was there, FDR asked if he could use the drawing on the bow of the USS Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Right.
And so Hirschfeld's drawings appeared.
Is it still there?
I don't know. I don't know if the USS FDR is still around. But for the time in 1944, it had a Hirschfeld on its bow. Hirschfeld used to say, if you live long enough, everything happens. Well, that is one of the things he's talking about.
Yeah.
He had a sandwich named after him, but when your artwork gets to be on a
what was the sandwich?
No, I don't know about the sandwich.
You don't know the sandwich?
He told me a sandwich was named after him, and I believe him.
Let's think about what would be on it. It would be a Reuben, wouldn't it?
It would be on pumpernickel bread with mayonnaise, so it would be black and white.
That's true. And maybe apple pancakes.
No, apple pancakes.
That's an Algonquin story. We'll tell that sometime.
Yeah, we'll tell. We'll do an Algonquin episode.
So I think we skipped over, or maybe we just haven't gotten there yet. I'm remembering the Eisenhower inauguration. Is that correct?
The
drawing he did, and it was in the style of Miguel Covarrubias.
Correct.
Was that for Collier's?
That was for Vanity Fair.
Oh, okay. So Vanity Fair got his back.
It
back
was
from
revived.
The dead.
And they got Hirschfeld, which meant they probably didn't last.
Yeah.
But it was Eisenhower's inauguration. They came to Hirschfeld, and he did it as an homage to his friend who had famously done a painting of Roosevelt's inauguration.
Gotcha.
And it's done very much in the style of Covarrubias.
It's very different. I view it as very flat.
Yes.
As opposed to the Hirschfeld work, which is very loose feeling and, you know, modeled.
Right. Where it really has almost three dimensions.
Yes.
Hirschfeld loved the piece, the Eisenhower inauguration, and it was hanging in one of his bathrooms.
Oh.
In fact, there were two American Mercury covers in his downstairs bathroom.
Really? Which
ones? De Gaulle and Churchill.
Oh, those are good ones. Yeah. The regular Churchill or the Churchill self-portrait? Okay. Yeah. My favorite American Mercury is the Churchill painting his self-portrait.
Oh, sure.
And that's really hard to find on eBay. So if you guys find it, just send it over.
Please send it to the Al Hirschfeld
Foundation.
I'll give
you my address.
Well, his political work didn't stop with that. Although, now, these were not, the covers for American Mercury were not overt political statements. They were portraits.
Right. No, they were definitely portraits.
They may include some elements of their personality, but they were portraits. They
like
were
Stalin has a hammer and sickle.
Right.
Like there's little, and like the John L. Lewis with the coal, like there are little kind of nods.
Right.
To what's going on, but there's no statement really made.
It's not a big overt statement. It's sort of poking fun at these famous figures.
Right.
But in after Hirschfeld had been commissioned by Colliers to do a retreat from Washington in 1948, and it didn't run, the following year they must have thought, well, Hirschfeld's got something. Let's get him on our editorial page.
Mm.
And the very first one.
This is the Times saying this.
No, this is Colliers.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, this is Colliers in 1949 asked him to, his first piece for their editorial page was the tax resister Vivian Kellams.
Oh, right.
She's holding a sign, and she's got collaged headlines behind her, very famous for not wanting to pay income tax.
Gotcha.
He did a handful of pieces over the next year. Probably his best work was his last one for Colliers on their editorial page, which was in July 1950. It was Senator Joseph McCarthy extinguishes the flame of the Statue of Liberty.
Mm, yeah, that's a good one.
And I think it gives us some sense of what kind of work he might have done on Father Conklin. You know, it's very hard hitting.
Yeah, it is.
Even if it's fairly simple.
It's a pretty bold statement.
Yes.
Yeah.
And very bold statement for the time, because to criticize McCarthy at that time, even as people started to think maybe this wasn't so great, was to open yourself up to being blacklisted.
Right.
And even after he, of course, even after he stopped supplying drawings for the editorial page, he would go on to supply drawings in the regular magazine and for an appointment with O'Hara and for different articles all the way through 1956. His next time on an editorial page comes 20 years later, really, or a little bit more, and of all places, it's the New York Times.
Mm.
Between 1971 and 1973, he was a regular presence on the op-ed page of the New York Times. He did drawings of Nixon, Spiro Agnew, who was called the Master of the Exploded Hyperbole.
Is that the one with the stuff coming out of his head?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Chief Justice Warren E. Burger, who's got thumbs up and thumbs down. He did international figures like Prince Norodom Sihanouk and the isolated Mao Zedong, who's shown on the Great Wall of China.
I definitely know who Prince Norodom Sihanouk is.
Not.
That's a joke. It's a bad joke. Okay, keep going.
Look it up. Now, again, these were not editorial cartoons, but sort of graphic summations of his subject. And although he wouldn't remain on the editorial page for much longer, he continued doing political work for the Times.
Yeah.
In 1976, both presidential conventions were held in New York. And not surprisingly, the Times did a special section for each convention.
Right.
And on the front of each of these sections was a Hirschfeld drawing. For the Democrats, it was Jimmy Carter walking down the street in a ticker tape parade. And for the Republicans, it was a boxing match between Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. And in the crowd, there's all kinds of people, some that we can recognize. And there's a little Al Hirschfeld and Dolly Paz.
Of course.
It's a great piece. In 1980, for their presidential coverage, he did drawings of many of the candidates for the party nominations, like Ted Kennedy, Jerry Brown, Bob Dole, John Connolly. 1984, he drew Reagan and Bush.
Mm.
In 1988, again on the op-ed page of the Times, during the Democratic National Convention, he did a drawing of Dukakis, Lloyd Benton, and Jesse Jackson at the Democratic National Convention.
Fun. And then he also did... he did a drawing in 1968 for The Nation's Business that were all of the Democratic candidates.
Yeah, that was a magazine. And no, it was Democrat and Republican
candidates. Oh, it was, because Ronald Reagan's in it. I'm sorry. I don't know why I thought that.
And in 1988, though, he just drew the Democratic candidates.
Gotcha. That's what I was thinking.
As a fundraiser.
I saw DNC and I on our notes and I just... I full steamed ahead. Yeah.
The only other president he drew as much as FDR, because he drew a number of drawings of FDR over the years, was, oddly enough, LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson. His first drawing was the inaugural gala.
Right.
Very well-known famous drawing that was later published as a limited edition etching, the original of which was given to Johnson in, he was, Hirschfeld and his family were invited down to the Oval Office.
Right.
I tell the story in the Hirschfeld Century. It's a crazy hour that he spends with LBJ, where he listens to Martin Luther King calling from the bridge at Selma.
Right. Now, do you think that drawing's still at the White House?
I don't think it's still at the White House. It might be in the Johnson Library.
Mm.
Something to...
Yeah.
In our spare time.
Yeah, definitely. and then there's the cute little book, My Year in the White House Doghouse, which features LBJ. It's kind of forgettable.
Very forgettable.
there are only like four or five drawings, and the best one is LBJ kind of cradling these two dogs next to him.
I think it's a collie and something else.
Yeah, like a shepherd.
Yeah. Yes, so his work on LBJ is nowhere near as distinguished as his work on FDR.
No, definitely.
And probably the last presidential candidate that he drew and was sort of involved in the campaign was in 2000 when Bill Bradley ran against Al Gore for the Democratic nomination. And he was asked to do a drawing of Bill Bradley that I guess they auctioned off or something like that. It was used to promote New York events. And so he did that. He thought Bill Bradley was pretty good. I'm sure he supported Gore in the general election.
Mm.
And then, of course, you know, it's not like theater and film did not have any political work in it. In fact, there was a lot of it, especially in the 30s when he really got started.
Well, all those group theater drawings.
All the group theaters. Yeah. Of the I Sing.
Right.
You know, the Gershwin, George Kaufman musical about the presidency and the White House. He drew that. There was I'd Rather Be Right, which was a Kaufman and Hart, Rogers and Hart musical fantasy about FDR. And this young couple wants to get married, but he needs to get work. And so FDR is in there. FDR, by the way, is played by George M. Cohan.
Of course.
I think it's the first time a sitting president is lampooned on a Broadway stage.
That's funny. Interesting.
And then probably... the most overt political work he did was for the Federal Theater Project, which was established in 1935, and it was an ambitious relief program for theater professionals. It was successful because it produced high-quality productions and employed as many, it employed really so many, and entertained even more. But it was also controversial. Its productions criticized Congress and the Supreme Court, and many would say that it spoke in a left-wing voice. He drew many of their productions, I mean, a wide range over their four-year period that it was around. Probably the most famous was in 1937 for Mark Blitzenstein's political allegory, the musical The Cradle Will Rock.
Are you sure it wasn't 1938?
It was January 1938. You were correct.
Yes!
William, she gets one this week.
Up to two.
Anyway, this was a show that was produced by and directed by Orson Welles.
Mm.
And on opening night, the government thought it was too controversial and they padlocked the theater.
Wow.
They would not let they wouldn't let any of the cast, the crew in, the producers or directors, and the whole first night audience, you know, came to the theater expecting to see a show and the theater was padlocked.
Isn't that illegal?
It is a matter of some contention. It's what the government could do.
Mm-hmm.
And Well, Orson Welles and producer John Houseman were not going to be deterred. They found another theater that was empty. They convinced the entire opening night crowd to walk with them up to the theater. And everybody sat in their seats, and Orson Welles got on stage with Mark Blitzenstein at a piano. And as Hirschfeld says, at a given signal, Mr. Blitzenstein struck the first chord of his revolutionary score when, to his astonishment and Mr. Welles, no less than the audience's, an actor from the cast stood up from his seat somewhere in the balcony and sang his rehearsed role. Mr. Blitzenstein had only to play the music, Mr. Welles only to stand there dumbfounded and delighted as actor after actor scattered throughout the house arose in his place and played his respective part. It was a memorable night in the theater.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. Hirschfeld was very, that was a remarkable night, one that he would remember. And his drawing of the production, which we don't know when it appeared. It's really one of the few drawings that we know of. The original drawing is now in the collection of the National Portrait Gallery. And they came to me at one point and said, well, this drawing appeared when the show opened, but that was 1938, and it has a Nina in it. Right. How is that possible? Mm-hmm. Well, the fact is, I think he added the Nina after the fact. He put it all on the sheet music at Blitzenstein's piano. So it's a wonderful piece, and it was a great night in the theater for Hirschfeld. I mean, for Hirschfeld to say it was a memorable night, you know it was a memorable night. He would also draw the International Ladies Garment Workers Review of Pins and Needles with music by his good friend Harold Rome. And then, you know, he drew the Louisiana Purchase in the 40s and the Crucible in the 50s and Hair and Assassin, and Angels in America, 1776.
One of my favorites.
He drew it twice. Yep. He drew the original production, which just showed the leads. And then when he, when the revival in the 1990s happened, he was so impressed by Tony Walton's set that he included the set of Independence Hall in the drawing.
That is a nice one. I like both of them.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, many, he did the poster for Mayer the Musical in 1985. Mm-hmm. But, of course, so many shows in the second half of the 20th century had political and certainly didactic content.
Right.
Whether it was South Pacific, you know, about racism, or Rent, you know, which touches on so many different issues.
Right. And then films, we also have the UA, the United Artists films. And those also have a lot of times a political message. I'm thinking of Defiant Ones.
Manchurian Candidate.
Right. You
know, Elmer Gantry. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are all pretty powerful films that had a real message to them. Mm-hmm. And really, they're called message movies.
Right.
And Hirschfeld didn't shy away from them and was equally good at drawing them as he was about drawing Victor Moore's Vice President Throttlebottom in Of the I Sing.
Now, that's a S.J. Perlman name.
Yes. In this case, it was a George S. Kaufman name.
Okay, close enough. That was close.
Even for the unlikely casting series that Hirschfeld did in 64 and 65, he did use some politics in it. One month, he did LBJ and Goldwater in Waiting for Godot, which is ridiculous. And in the year before, for Famous Feuds, he did Lenny Bruce in The Fuzz, which, again, is not overtly political in the sense that it's a political figure, but Lenny Bruce was certainly a political figure in the sense of his struggles with the First Amendment.
I see.
So Hirschfeld believed that you really had to be involved in politics, particularly as a young person, and that you should be interested in the politics of your time. And as he got older, I think he felt that the world... You know, I think he may have felt that the world might not change as quickly as he would like, but he clearly understood that human nature was such that people would never stop trying.
Right.
And it was that kind of optimistic recognition that kept him current even as he aged. Mm. You know, he understood people, which is at the core of what he wanted. He told me he gave up political work because he wasn't comfortable picking the good guys and the bad guys.
Right.
You know, in many ways, it was constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when he did the theater work, the playwrights picked the good guys and the bad guys, and he didn't have to worry about that. He could focus on the drawing,
right,
which at the end of the day was what he was most interested in.
Mm-hmm. We hope you have learned a little something more about Hirschfeld and political happenings of the 20th century.
Yes, it's just one more prism that we can see Hirschfeld's mm-hmm. work through.
Mm-hmm.
You can go on our, we'll have links, of course, to all these drawings in the show notes. You can also just go to our website, alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
Correct.
Go to the advanced search and under type in political, and it will bring up
In your favorite politician.
You can type in your favorite politician, or you can just put in political, and you'll see hundreds of political drawings.
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes post them on our Twitter and Facebook
mm-hmm.
pages. Why don't you tell them where they can
find
us?
Sure. On Facebook, we're the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. And Instagram and Twitter, we are at Al Hirschfeld. Of course, I'm going to put all the drawings in the show notes so you can follow along. But you can also find the podcast at alhirschfeldfoundation.org/podcasts. That's with an S, and the S is for Stalin.
Do you hear that?
Is there a better one? Is there a better S? I'm thinking very quickly and I can't come up. 1776.
1776. Right. There you go.
All right,
that's
for 1776. We would love to hear from you. Also, if you could rate and review us on iTunes or your podcasting app of your choice, we very much appreciate it. We like to read them, and it helps other people find the podcast too. So tell your friends.
And if you have questions, concerns, corrections, or advice,
mm-hmm.
you can always write to us at info@alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
Right.
We'd love to hear from you.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you on the next Hirschfeld Century podcast.
Yes. Bye.
Bye-bye.